All right, this is an oral history project interview with Professor Frederick Cassidy. Today is November 9th.
5th.
5th, I'm sorry, I'm out of my
Guy Fawkes Day.
Yes, 1985, and I'm Martin Dowling. And we want to talk about your career as a linguist and editor of dictionaries. I'd like to just go way back to Jamaica to start off. You were just there for your first 10 years, right?
11
nearly, years.
That must have been. Yes, well, I was born in Jamaica, West Indies. At the time, it was called British West Indies, and it still is within the British Commonwealth. And I was born on the 10th of October, 1907, in Kingston, or at least a suburb of Kingston, which is the capital of Jamaica.
Had your family been there for quite some time? Or?
Yes, I think my mother was born in Jamaica, but my father was born in Canada, New Brunswick, Canada, and he had come down there partly for his health and partly for business. Mm-hmm. And then they met in Jamaica and married, and I'm the second son. The first is Harold G. Cassidy, who was a professor of chemistry at Yale University for most of his career, is now retired. He's a year older.
Mm-hmm. And did your parents stay down there?
They stayed down there until after the, well, you see, the World War started in 1914, yes. First World War, and they stayed there till the war was over, and then they came up north where my father had a business offer. Mm-hmm. In Akron, Ohio, and that's where we transferred to.
Did that stay have any long-lasting effect? Did that stay in Jamaica have any long-lasting effect for you?
Oh, of course. It was my childhood home.
Yeah.
And a very, very deep impression. And I go back to Jamaica whenever I can. I have no relatives left there. But I do have some friends and certainly many associations. Mm-hmm.
But in an academic way,
I went to Miss Beckwith's school, which was a little private school with, I suppose, six or eight pupils near my home and therefore very easy to go to. Miss Beckwith being a Scotswoman who was down in Jamaica. I don't know how she ever got there, but she and her mother, widowed mother, and her daughter and her sister were down there, and Miss Amy Beckwith had her little school, and I was at it, so was my brother, and we just simply were close by. It was a good little preparatory school until we went to Jamaica College. Jamaica College started taking boys at about the age of 10, mm-hmm. And so I was there for a year or so.
So that was your first...
That was my first education.
Yes. Was that also your first experience, perhaps, with different dialects of language? That's what I want to...
Oh, yes, yes. Well, of course, in Jamaica, the ordinary people, the workmen and country people growing their crops and marketing them, and people who do all kinds of trades, carpenters and plumbers and gardeners and all kinds of people, speak, in general, the local Creole English. That is to say, it's like any Creole language. It's a language which was worked out by the slaves from Africa who were, and this of course applies only to the Caribbean, but there are Creole languages in other parts of the world too. But the ones in the Caribbean were brought as slaves to work on mostly sugar plantations, and then, of course, they learned what English they could in an African language pattern. That's what a Creole language is. Mm-hmm. It's mostly grammatical structures of African languages, many different African languages, but not full structures. They lose a lot of the African, and they don't gain all of the English,
right.
So that the language that results is somewhat simplified, but nevertheless as complex as languages usually are, and it can develop into a full-fledged language, as it has in Jamaica. It's got a great many English words, but they are, I suppose the majority of words are English words, but they are quite often disguised, in a great many cases disguised by phonetic changes that took place as the language was being learned and developed by the Caribbean-born people of African descent.
Now, that wasn't a language that you called your own while you were there?
It was just the language that the servants and the tradesmen and the country people all spoke, and still do speak. But at home we spoke standard English.
Yeah. Did you hear it in school?
Well, oh yes, the schools are all taught in standard English, and Jamaica College is a private school.
Oh, yeah.
That is, you had to pay to go to it. It wasn't a tax-free school. And so the people who wanted English-style education went to the various schools. Jamaica College was one of them. There were half a dozen others, quite good ones, and using the English school pattern in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we spoke, nothing but standard English at home, but of course we all knew and understood, and I suppose as a child I could, without any trouble at all, switch into Creole, because that's what was going on all around me all the time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose you could say I was bidialectal.
Right.
I had two dialects. One was a standard dialect and the other was this Creole dialect. And I'm using the word dialect the way linguists would use it. It means any form of any language.
Did you pick up a third one then when you came to Ohio?
Well, there weren't very many things that were different.
No.
Pronunciation was different. All the new things that were different in things, names for things, and things that happened in Akron, Ohio, that did not happen in Jamaica. Of course, I learned names and words for those, but the language was English, and I didn't have the kind of trouble that a person speaking German or French or Spanish would have had adapting at all. It fitted in perfectly normally, except that things were done quite a bit differently there, and sometimes I got some surprises, some unpleasant surprises, because I found in Akron that a big green bell pepper was called a mango in the stores. Now that's a bit of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly a word used farther south, but I did see it in grocery stores, and I thought these people must be absolutely ignorant to call that a mango. I knew what a mango was. A mango is a sweet fruit that grows on a tree. It's not a bell pepper. That was my boyhood reaction to the whole thing. And there were two or three other words that what they called a yam is really a sweet potato. And they're called yams everywhere now. The word seems to have spread everywhere, but they're not true yams. The true yam is a quite different root that is eaten widely in Africa, and which came from from America, was taken to Africa, just as a number of other things were. But that was a sort of surprise of adaptation to a new environment that I suppose anybody would have. Those two words happened to strike me.
Yeah. Well, did this interest in words sort of stand out for you at that age more than curiosities of life?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I've always been interested in words, and naturally enough, when you have some experience like that, where a word that you know perfectly well is misused in a foreign land, you think that people are ignorant. What it is, of course, is when you learn more about language, it is simply that words have different meanings, different applications. It is the same word, but in one place they call it one thing, and in another place they call it another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or it applies to one thing, or applies to another thing. So one has to be more open-minded about language, and that's one of the things we learn when we hear more than one language. I think that's the value of foreign languages in schools. It opens people up. They don't remain naive about language. They don't remain thinking that one language is the only possible one or the only good one or something like that. The fact is that there's all kinds of language being used, and being used in the way language can be used for communication. As long as two people understand a word, they can communicate in it. As long as they understand it the same way,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
If I went into a grocery store and wanted to buy a mango today in Madison, I think I could get it.
Yes.
But that's because, partly because, that they don't use the word mango for green peppers here, and because grocery stores now are beginning to import real mangoes, so I wouldn't have any trouble.
Right.
But that's just one item.
So you were in high school, then in Akron, and grade school, the rest of your grade school?
Yes, my brother and I entered high school at once, South High, mm-hmm. South High School, and then we went on to Central High School. And graduated from there together.
Did he also go to Oberlin? Did you go to Oberlin?
Yes, he did eventually. We both started at the university, at Akron University, which is a municipal university. And we both started there and had our freshman years there. But then the family went back to Jamaica, and we wanted to stay and finish out high school, which we did, and then we continued and went to college. And I went to Oberlin first, and then convinced my brother that he ought to come there, which he did, and he took his degree from Oberlin also, his M.A.
Mm-hmm. And what was your major then in college? Were you an English major from the start?
No, I took the usual, you know, the normal pattern in colleges is to make you spread out in the first two years, and then you choose a major and concentrate more in the latter two years. And that was perfectly good. I think it's a sound pattern. In any case, it certainly suited me, and I took the general courses, you know, geography and mathematics and philosophy and English and so on, and art. I liked art and almost decided to major in art, but the English department had, for me at least, more attractive members and
mm-hmm.
And I got more out of it, so I went into English.
Mm-hmm. Did you was there any family or outside influences on your career decisions or anything?
No, my brother and I were unfortunately, well, I don't know about unfortunately, because we came out all right, but we had to be cut off from the family because they had gone back to Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
and they were having some business difficulties. And we had to make it on our own, which we did perfectly all right. I mean, we worked summers and got our tuition money, and we worked while we were in school. We waited in restaurants and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, lots of students do it.
Yeah.
I think it's very healthy.
Yeah.
Myself, some colleges insist on it. Some colleges, like, Antioch College. The Antioch Plan, it was very well known 25 years ago. The Antioch Plan was that a student should take one semester off and go and do some job out in what they call the real world,
mm-hmm.
as if college weren't the real world. But in any case, that is the Antioch Plan, and the college cooperated to get students to do that sort of thing. I think it's very good because you get experience, mm-hmm. and you have to bear responsibility. And so especially for the kind of student who's led a sort of sheltered life, that's an excellent thing.
Yes. Well, there seems to be a danger these days of people borrowing money rather than working their way through college.
In honesty and pay it back afterwards, that's perfectly all right. I had to borrow money to finish my degrees, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I borrowed some from Oberlin, and I had to borrow some more from University of Michigan where I did my graduate work. But I gradually paid them back, and it was perfectly all right. The universities and colleges, I think, normally have a fund from which students are able to borrow. And sometimes they have grants, gifts, and then of course there are, fortunately, some fellowships so that the ones who are doing better, scholarships and mm-hmm. fellowships, can get some money without further toil.
Well, let's go back to your, what got you started on English?
I don't know. It was a very good department there.
Yeah.
Interesting professors, interesting subject matter. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed I've always enjoyed poetry and music and things like that. And the artistic side I enjoyed too, but I just chose English by preference. Mm-hmm. No, I had no difficulty at all there. I would very willingly read and work in the library and so forth. Well, it's not that I didn't do other things. I did, but mm-hmm. I was not built to be a football player. Nor a basketball player. I mean that kind of thing. I simply wasn't built for it. I'm perfectly healthy, but I'm not able to compete against much bigger guys, and so I just didn't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other things that I could get into. I got into clubs. I got into plays. I did plays in English, French, and Latin. I remember in high mm-hmm. school we had a Latin play, and I was in on that.
You had foreign languages in high school?
Oh yes, we mm-hmm. had foreign languages, and the Latin play made sort of a hit in Latin, so they made us translate it and give it again in English. Because most of the students didn't know Latin, of course. But I had a normal high school experience, and because of a quick start in Jamaica, where they push the students along in the English plan, they push them along faster, and they get into academic subjects sooner, I think, than normally in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually graduated from high school at 15. It wasn't the age of 15. It wasn't because I was any brighter than anybody else. I just simply because I had been pushed along more to begin with.
So you arrived in Ohio a couple of steps ahead?
Well, I stayed out for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And earned my living before mm-hmm. going to Oberlin, and that was a very good thing, because then I was on the same age level as my classmates, mm-hmm. and I was able to enjoy the social things that are an important part of college life. Social things, you know, going around with the guys and dating and mm-hmm. Dancing mm-hmm. and going to the movies and all the other normal things, but they're part of college life because you've got people of your own age in a healthy, generally healthy atmosphere, and the ones who seem to be your own type, we just naturally club together.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had a good time, made a lot of friends. Oberlin was a very good thing for me, very good. It's a good college to begin with. They had fine staff and good library facilities and fine campus.
Any of the staff that stick out in your mind? Any of the English?
Oh yes. There were at least two professors who were. One had done a good deal of publishing on literary subjects. It was mm-hmm. Professor Charles Henry Adams Wager, W-A-G-E-R, Wager. Charles Henry Adams. He was mm-hmm. the head of the English department, and his specialties were the Italian Renaissance, although that wasn't English literature, but it was one of his interests. And he also was in the 19th century literature, English literature, and other things too. He was all over the place, but I mean to say those were his special mm-hmm. interests. And he would have us, English department, seniors, juniors and seniors, he would have us in once a week, I think, a Thursday afternoon. Mrs. Wager would serve tea and cookies or something, and we'd go and sit in his study, in Professor Wager's study, and chat about literature. It was a very pleasant thing. We enjoyed it, and he enjoyed it, and he had books that we hadn't seen and pictures of literary figures, and he would chat about them most interestingly, and his travels and his living. He lived for a while in Florence, Italy, while he was studying Italian literature. He was a Dante scholar, and he also was very much interested in St. Francis of Assisi.
Mm.
So those two subjects came up fairly often. And then that was one of the professors that I enjoyed. The other one, yes.
Did you do go on, tell me about the other one.
No, well, the other one was Professor Jelliffe, J-E-L-L-I-F-F-E, Jelliffe. Professor Jelliffe was a golfer. I didn't play golf, but that does characterize him, because some of the English department guys, football players and others, the sports guys, the athletic crew, liked Jelliffe because he was a golfer. So he would take them out for a round here and there on the Oberlin golf course. I didn't go for golf, but I knew him other way. He had a little literary club of his own, and we'd meet perhaps once a month in his living room at night. He was writing a novel, and he'd read us a chapter here and there. And then we would be writing other things, little stories or poetry or something else, and we'd bring that in and read it to each other. It was a very pleasant experience, very healthy. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go into the world of literature in any form, then that kind of thing can be very pleasant. And they certainly did it well, those at that time in Oberlin, and I don't think Oberlin is certainly one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. So
those informal gatherings are more memorable for you than your more official work. Did you do a BA paper or MA paper there?
Oh, I did BA and went back later on and did an MA there. No, I was going for honors, which means extra work and extra reading, and also the privilege of being in the honors room in the library, which not all the hoi polloi were not allowed in there. Mm-hmm. And I could get books out that other people were not.
No football allowed. Players there.
Well, I think the football players did without it. No, they weren't a bad lot. I had one football player, was my roommate in graduate school. He invited me to come in and be his roommate, and we got along beautifully together. Mm-hmm. It's not I was interested in football, for heaven's sakes. I enjoyed it when we had football games and went over and won and so on. But I just couldn't get to the games. I didn't have the money for the tickets. Truth of the matter, I finally got so that I was a gate guard, traffic director, and then I could get into the football games free.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm absolutely not against the athletic crew. I just couldn't be on a par with them because I wasn't built for it. But they were perfectly good friends, the ones that I knew. One of them was my roommate for a while, and then an undergraduate roommate, and then another one, Bill Tenney, was my graduate school roommate. We had an apartment together. No, I think that the college experience and the university experience were nothing but healthy and favorable.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly enjoyed myself there as well as the circumstances allowed. Never had enough money, but.
Well.
Who does?
Yeah.
But in fact, if you had too much money, then you got into some kinds of activities that I wouldn't have enjoyed anyway. They had no fraternities or sororities at Oberlin, and so that kind of, somewhat overheated social activity in which, if you join a fraternity or a sorority, you have to do certain things that you might not choose to do otherwise, or that you mightn't be able to afford otherwise. But whatever, I have no objection to them. They're like everything else, some good ones and some troublesome ones. But that's just something that wasn't at Oberlin, but we had plenty of other activities that were very pleasant, and one of the things I enjoyed there very much was my board job at the French House, the Maison Française. I had learned French before, college French, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I was was not a good speaker of French yet, but I had learned it enough so that I could carry on conversations at the French house, even though I wasn't taking any more courses in it, and I got a board job there. So I washed dishes and peeled vegetables and mm-hmm. so on. Same old thing, lots of guys are doing it now, girls too. I think it's a healthy thing, at least it did me no harm.
What did you write on then, your master's?
My master's thesis was on Matthew Arnold, English essayist and poet of the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, once visited Madison on a lecture tour and commented on the lakes, the Madison Lakes, and that his commentary on that was printed long, long ago in the Wisconsin State Journal, by the way. Matthew Arnold was, in his time, considered the topmost English critic, and he was a poet of considerable power. His poetry is still read, much of it. He's got some very fine things. Of course, no poet's stuff is always good or equally satisfying, mm-hmm. but.
So you weren't doing any real any linguistics or your interest in just from your syllabus of work.
Well, the English language always interested me, and it was literary English, I suppose, while I was in college. But I also started to do a course in Anglo-Saxon literature,
mm-hmm.
which means the earliest stage of the English language, and so different from present-day English. Because of all the changes in between, so different that you really can't just pick up something in Old English, in Anglo-Saxon, and read it. It's too different. But I got interested there in it, and I also decided that anybody who was going to understand Anglo-Saxon or English literature or things in general ought to learn some German. So I took a course in German, course in German, and never regretted that. That was good. I had had Latin in high school, had had French and Spanish along the way, and the Latin and the Anglo-Saxon, then I got into that quite naturally and enjoyed that. It's got some fine, very fine literature. You have to work to get it, but then once you've got it, it's an appreciation for the mm-hmm. rest of your life. Mm-hmm.
When in this period did you sort of decide that you wanted to, study?
Well, I had been in a very unpleasant kind of life in Akron, Ohio. After my family left and went back to Jamaica, I just sort of trickled along from day to day, not mm-hmm. doing much of anything, and just had a little empty kind of job to keep body and soul together, and it wasn't leading anywhere.
You must have lived with your brother then.
Mm-hmm.
Did you live with your brother?
Yes, my brother and I shared a room within a private home.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked at night and slept in the day, and I worked in the day and slept at night. So we saw
got
each
a long
other
time.
Yes, he would come in and I would go out. We saw each other weekends.
I'm going to just flip this.
But anyway, I would say, I suppose, that I enjoyed being in college and learning all the things I was learning. I enjoyed that so much that I didn't want to do anything else until the natural way out of that was to become a college teacher, mm-hmm. if I could. And then I got a little job after the BA was over. I got a little job at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. On the staff of a dictionary, the Dictionary of Early Modern English. Dictionary of Early Modern English.
Right, okay.
No, I've got that turned around. It's Early Modern English Dictionary, EMED.
That's right.
Early Modern English Dictionary. And that was just clerical work, but it was on a dictionary, and we were dealing with the language of just before Shakespeare's time and after, right up, well, from the beginning of printing at the end of the 15th century mm-hmm. to 1700, the year 1700 or so. So that was a very interesting period.
Were you involved with the research there at all? Or?
Not for the research.
How was the research for that one?
Well, they had inherited about 1 million quotation slips of paper with quotations written on them from the big Oxford English Dictionary, which sent these things over, and they were filed there, and it was decided that before the EMED, Early Modern English Dictionary, could be made, they had to collect a great deal more material in places which the Oxford Dictionary had neglected or hadn't been able to get at that time. So they were busy in a collecting program, reading older books, taking out quotations from them, finding and doing some research on those when you had a word that you couldn't track down, you didn't know what it meant, and there wasn't enough evidence on it, then you'd have to do some research. But I was at the bottom of the pile. I was just doing clerical work, copying things, but I, again, rather got involved in the thing because the language fascinated me. And what happened was that whenever the other people doing the same kind of work, whenever they came across a word that they couldn't decode, they'd give it to me. Mm-hmm. Well, then I became a kind of minor detective. I would track down these words and try to explain them. And I had a good deal of fun out of that. Mm-hmm. And I usually could find out
where would you go?
Well, for one thing, if you read around it, read the context of it, it mm-hmm. begins to make better sense. If you take it one word in one sentence, you don't have enough context. You don't know what it's all about. And the other people didn't care very much. They were putting in their time, and they were doing it honestly enough, but they weren't specially interested, and I was. So every time one of these words came up that they couldn't explain, they'd give it to me, and I had a lot of fun. I explained them, I chased them down, I looked them up in the Oxford Dictionary and other dictionaries and tried to see what other evidence I could get on them. And I did certainly amuse myself at it and got myself a little mm-hmm. sort of detective status. Yes.
This was 1932?
I went to 1931. Mm-hmm. I graduated in the class of 1930 from Oberlin. Right. And then I went on in the fall of 31 to Ann Arbor. Yes, 31. I stayed there until 38 when I got my doctorate.
But I thought you got your M.A. from Oberlin, is that?
Mm-hmm. I got the M.A. 2 years later. I went to Michigan, but I did not finish the M.A. until later. I worked at it in absentia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right. You're quite right. Check the dates.
So how long were you employed then at the early
dictionary?
English?
I stayed there off and on all the time that I was in Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
I moved up to sub-editorship, but I was with them off and on. I had a year out there in Europe and wasn't working for them. And then also I had to spend some time taking classes, finishing my mm-hmm. doctor's degree and so on, writing my dissertation. But whenever I wasn't doing that, And whenever I wasn't on a fellowship, I did have some fellowships there, which were a great help. On a fellowship, somebody is, the money is furnished, and you don't have to do whatever job you were doing to keep going, and so you can spend more time on your studies. That's the whole point of it, of course. I had that for a couple of years. And then I kept working on the dictionary off and on the whole time. Then I finished the doctorate in 1938.
Mm-hmm. What did you pursue in your coursework there?
The required courses mm-hmm. in English literature. If you're taking a course in English literature, you have to cover all the different periods of the language. You have to have a course in Old English and a course in Middle English and a course in early modern English and the 17th century and the 18th century and the 19th century and the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Each of the centuries has a sort of a body of literature that's thought of in those terms. And so I took courses in most of them. I'm afraid I neglected American literature. I had only one course there. I have always regretted that I didn't have more, but I've been reading to try to catch up on it. In any case, I had the regular courses that everybody else had to have. And also, you know, there are always on a campus, there are some, in a department, there are some professors who are considered exciting, learned, helpful, whatever you want, mm-hmm. and the students flock to them. That's the way it should be.
Who were they then? We got the ones at Oberlin.
Keep the professors on their toes. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I don't know. I would say that of the professors I had there, the one who stands out in my mind best of all was William Gorham Rice. R-I-C-E, Rice.
Gorham as in?
William Gorham, G-O-R-H-A-M,
yeah, okay.
as in Gorham Street, Madison. Rice, R-I-C-E.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Professor Rice was he was both in the field of 17th century, he's a Miltonist, and he also had written, was taught a course on Matthew Arnold, which was what I did for my MA thesis. So that, of course, attracted me to him. He was supposed to be extremely tough, and you had to work your head off for William Gorham Rice, but that's one of the reasons why I remember him. Mm-hmm. I did work my head off, mm-hmm. but I got an A. And I learned about Milton. I had a tremendous course there. I think Milton's my favorite poet. As a result of this, what Milton writes about is not always what I'm especially interested in, but he certainly writes about it wonderfully, wrote about it wonderfully. So that's one of the things that I enjoyed. Oh, I had other professors that I enjoyed. The man I did my dissertation under was Charles Carpenter Freese, F-R-I-E-S, and he was a linguist, an outstanding one. And that's where, perhaps between that and the dictionary, I shifted my interest more and more toward language. It doesn't mean that I gave up literature or that I forgot about it. And some of the present-day linguists know very little of literature, and I think it's to their disadvantage. But the linguists of that time were all men with a wide general education and knowing many languages, and so it was a good time. Nowadays, the linguists tend to be, I think, to spend too much time battling about theory and not doing as much careful work in language study as they used to do. And they sometimes, some of them start talking about it as if they knew more than they do, and that's always sort of dismal, because there's no use reading this stuff if the person isn't obviously a really good scholar in it. You don't want to waste your time. And yet they can get themselves published, some of them. Mm. Result?
The linguists were then in the English department.
Well, most linguistics departments developed out of language departments. Language might be the classical languages, Latin, Greek, Sanskrit, other languages like that. That was often the growing place, the seedbed of linguistics. English departments were very much so at Michigan. The German department was very much so, I think, as an inheritance from 19th century German study of philology, in which the Germans were among the very top philologists of the 19th century. The French department at Michigan was better than some in regard to language rather than literature, I mean. But some departments, some French departments concentrate on literature and leave language aside, and I would say that's not a good thing. However, that's true of all kinds of language departments, but I would say that the linguistics departments developed out of language departments in general. And then they also have been very much affected in more recent years by sociology and anthropology approaches, which means that there's less historical linguistics done and more theoretical linguistics. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, well, it's valuable, there's no question about it, but I think some of it is overdone, and there are things that need to be done that get neglected because of this overemphasis on theory.
Do you have that in mind? Had you had that in mind with your various works?
No,
did you consciously steer away from the...
No, I don't think so. You have to have theory. I like my theory to be based on research in language and the study of particular languages. Sometimes it lives in the air. It's mm-hmm. it's not concrete enough to suit me. I prefer to have very concrete basis for my theory, and so I have found myself, in fact, criticizing the theorists who didn't know language well enough before they started theorizing. I could point to some, but I won't. In any case, my interest and my preference lay in historical linguistics. And then, of course, if you're doing a dictionary, and if you're doing a historical dictionary, which is, of course, what the big Oxford Dictionary was and is, and which I have always taken as my model, then you keep on paying attention to the historical side of things. That means research in past times. The effect of the war, the Second World War, was to take a good many brilliant young linguists and throw them into the problem of teaching language as rapidly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of at least one man, as I say, he's brilliant. He is brilliant. He's still alive. And he had a brilliant career and produced a great deal of valuable stuff in language study. But what happened to him was that he was a draftee in the army, and they needed to have somebody to teach Chinese to some naval officers. And the people who were in charge of the program and trying to find the appropriate linguists to do it, this was for the Army and Navy, for the armed forces programs, very necessary for the war, they simply tapped him and said, "How would you like to teach a course in Chinese?" And he said, "Well, I don't know any Chinese, but I think I could keep ahead of my students." And it's a language I've always wanted to crack. So they said, "All right, you're leaving San Francisco in a week." And they furnished him materials enough so that he could begin to learn Chinese, and he did keep ahead of his students all the way around from San Francisco and through the Panama Canal and on around to the Pacific Theater. He went around the long way around.
Who was that?
It was Charles Hockett, but he did have his naval officers speaking simple colloquial Chinese when they got off the ship in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the types of things that happened because of the pressure of the war. And there were other people who, young, brilliant young men, who got into cryptanalysis, for example. One of them was on our staff here in Madison, Martin Jose. He was a brilliant linguist. But he got into cryptanalysis, and he worked with the Bell Telephone Laboratories, and he worked with the Armed Forces, and so on. There are many others I could name, but those two happened to have... Well, at least the second one happens to have a Wisconsin connection. That threw linguistics into studying the studying languages all over the world, many of them exotic languages which had not been studied before. And of course, every human being has language, but languages differ among themselves very much. What's necessary in one language is maybe quite unheard of in another. And so around, and mm-hmm. any one of those languages is as good as the other in terms of having human beings communicate with each other.
What happened to you during the war?
Oh, I was here in Madison. I had small children.
Well, why don't we back? I should back up a little and get first finish up at Michigan, and then we'll get to the war in Madison.
Yes.
I
must go in about 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, maybe we can pick this up another day. After.
Well, let me mention my wife at least. We met in Oberlin. She was the first international fellow between France and Oberlin, and she came in then on a fellowship, and her duty was to teach phonetics of French and pronunciation of French and also some French literature, but she mostly was helping in the French phonetics laboratory and also was number two at the French house, the Maison Française. They had a table, and she had to keep the students talking French during the meals and keep the conversation going.
You had mentioned earlier that that's where you were working?
I was working at the French house, and that's where I met her.
Okay.
And we were there in the year 1929 to 30, and she was taking an MA degree, I was taking a BA, and that's where we got engaged. So. Mm-hmm. Then we got married in 1931, and she came on for graduate work to Ann Arbor too, and she took her doctorate there in comparative literature, English and French. I was doing the English language, but we went through Ann Arbor together and got our doctorates in 1938. So then we came to Madison in 39, and that was...
Were you in at Strasbourg together too?
Well, yes. It was her father was a professor at the University of Strasbourg, and he knew about a little annual job of being the lecteur de langue anglaise, lecturer in English language, and he got me in line for it, and they gave it to me, and so we were there for the year 1935-36. We spent that year in Strasbourg, and both at the university. I was doing my dissertation, she was doing hers too, and we worked at those two dissertations. We had got along far enough so that was all that was left to finish our degrees, and so that was it. She taught at a girls' school in Strasbourg, and I taught at the university. We managed to keep ourselves going that way.
Yeah, that's very nice to be both.
It's a good year.
With the same.
It's a very good year.
Interests.
And then when we came back, we still had to finish up our dissertations, but we did, and finished them in 1938. And got some first teaching at the university.
Yeah, I was
going
to ask you about, did you teach much?
The English department had a rule against having any women as instructors. It sounds strange these days, but they did have a hard and fast rule. And I know of only one exception to that rule during the time that we were there or shortly after that. But at any rate, my wife had a graduate assistantship teaching. Not teaching. She was an assistant to one of the professors in the English department, Professor Howard Mumford Jones. And she was working in French and English for her doctorate. So altogether, we managed to squeak through, financially.
Yeah.
And then we came to Madison. We had one child then, and had the rest of our family here in Madison. Four children.
What did you teach?
Well, I taught English. Mm-hmm. Well, you mean specific courses? Well, when you get your first job, you teach freshman English.
Yeah.
Teach freshman English, and if you're lucky, you get a chance in some sophomore English.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I taught. so.
Well, maybe we should just leave it there and pick it up with the war maybe another time, okay. And then get
this
talk
me.
About Jamaican dictionary and dare after
yeah.
that.
Okay.